Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals standing with more than 600,000 workers in education, human services, and healthcare with the Our Voice, Our Values, Our Union campaign. And United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.
Senate Majority Leader Charles Schumer was at Albany Medical Center this week promoting legislation he says would cap the cost of insulin at $35 a month. The Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas reports.
The New York Democrat says individual insulin vials sell for as much as $600, and one in four diabetics ration their insulin at great risk to their health because they can't afford it. Diabetes is the eighth leading cause of death in the U.S. Schumer says no Capital Region family should have to go bankrupt just because they need insulin to survive.
In Albany County, it's estimated 7.9% of adults are diagnosed with diabetes. In Rensselaer County, 8.7% have diabetes. In Saratoga County, 7.8% have diabetes. And in Schenectady County, 9.5% have diabetes.
Schumer points out that in New York, black adults with diabetes are almost twice as likely to die than their white or Hispanic counterparts. He says 1.7 million New Yorkers have diabetes. 450,000 have it, but don't know it. He heaped blame for the high prices on drug manufacturers.
This is not a patented drug, you know, where you have to go pay the pharmaceutical company money for all their research and investment. It was invented in 1921 by a Canadian doctor whose name was Alexander Fleming. And he was such a decent man that he donated all the research for $1. So, you know, you hear, well, you got to pay a lot for these medicines because there's a patent and you have to pay for the cost of development. Not here. The reason the cost is so high is the outrageously convoluted system with the pharmaceutical companies and the distributors of these drugs, who pay far more attention to their own profitability than to helping people.
Dr. Linda Riddick, professor of pediatrics and head of the Division of Pediatric Endocrinology at Albany Med, says insurance also only allows patients a certain amount of insulin per month.
Children with diabetes need insulin in order to live. But for too many families, the skyrocketing out-of-pocket costs make it difficult for them to obtain this medication, even when they have insurance. It is even more hardship for those who have a high copay or they have a high deductible. Also, insurance companies only cover insulin for 1 month, a certain amount of insulin just for 1 month. They will not cover replacement insulin vials.
Riddick says she often sees parents distraught after a vial was accidentally dropped or lost, which can turn into hundreds of dollars lost. Schumer explained that the Affordable Insulin Now Act would cap out-of-pocket costs of insulin products at $35 per month for people with private health plans and Medicare Part D plans, including Medicare Advantage. Coretta Killikelly, founder and executive director of Albany not-for-profit CEKRN Consulting, says adult patients are also adversely affected by soaring costs. She spoke of a patient on a fixed income struggling to manage his diabetes.
His plan for treating his chronic illnesses is to go to the ER. When he feels ill, where he will be stabilized, then discharge, and in a few months, the cycle continues. Unfortunately, this is the consensus for majority of our clients. This is not a solution. This practice is a recipe for disaster and negative impacts on many levels. A decrease in the quality of life for this individual, the cost associated with caring for patients who are readmitted for unmanaged chronic illnesses such as diabetes. One solution that would remedy this situation is to make medications more affordable for all.
The House approved the Affordable Insulin Now Act in November. Schumer says he'll bring the legislation to a vote in the Senate in March.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Joining us now, Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Shartok. Alan, interesting conversation this week with the head of the Democratic Party in New York State, Jay Jacobs. Among things that you talked about was the race for governor in New York and Tom Suozzi, the representative who has jumped into the race, a Democrat, who Jacobs acknowledged he at one point was his campaign manager and sort of went on a soliloquy. You could tell he wasn't happy that he had advised Tom not to get in the race and wasn't happy about it, as it looks like Governor Hochul will have an easy trail to the governor's seat. The question was prompted because Suozzi said Hillary Clinton called him and said not to run.
Well, yeah, look, the Democratic establishment, and it's to the right of the Democratic establishment, these are not progressives. These are people who count, among others, Alphonse D'Amato, you know, he's not exactly a Democrat, for support. But I can tell you that it's not going to be as easy a ride as some people think it is for the governor now, because she is not doing that well in the polls. People are not really convinced. Now, let's remember that, you know, Democratic politicians usually come from New York City or the environment. They don't come from Buffalo or that region, which would be one reason why these polls are showing up rather indecisive for this governor. Maybe Suozzi knows that. Maybe Suozzi says, okay, maybe this is my chance. I can do this now because people aren't all that excited about the present governor. That's a possibility. That may be what is encouraging him. Or he may be one of those guys who just says, what the heck, I'll just do it, and if somebody salutes, that's a good thing. But I'll tell you now, they're not happy about this kind of opposition because her support is weak.
Well, Andrew Cuomo, the former governor, had to resign because of a report by the AG of sexual harassment, at least 11 accusers. And now he has a new ad, Alan, a TV ad in an attempt to make a comeback. The 30-second spot selectively strings together snippets from TV reports about the outcomes in those cases to bolster Cuomo's continued claims of exoneration. It highlights recent decisions by five district attorneys to not bring charges against Cuomo for sexual harassment for technical reasons. But what do you make of the new ad by Cuomo?
Well, the Shartok twins used to say to each other again and again, I hate to say I told you so, but I told you so.
And you
I've
did.
Been telling you all along that he's not done, that whatever his angels or devils are, he will move forward unless there's a good reason not to. Do I approve of this? No. Do I think that he will do everything he can to bolster his image and regain whatever power he may have lost? Yes, I do.
Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Shartok. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Governor Kathy Hochul says she'll work more closely with local governments on allowing accessory dwelling units, or ADUs, now that the governor has dropped the proposal following a backlash. The Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt explains.
An accessory dwelling unit, or ADU, is a separate, smaller housing unit built on the same lot as a single-family home. It also includes backyard cottages or apartments in attics, garages, or basements. Governor Hochul proposed in her budget that homeowners be allowed to bypass local zoning laws, particularly in the suburbs, that forbid the units. Localities could impose safety and size regulations as long as those rules did not prevent reasonable new construction. The plan was backed by over 60 organizations, including many housing advocacy groups and the AARP. They say it could help with the affordable housing shortage and keep seniors out of nursing homes. Assembly sponsor Harvey Epstein, speaking at a rally in mid-February, called the proposal a win-win.
It benefits homeowners across New York, giving them extra income, allowing them to use space, potentially for caretakers or other family members, provides new affordable housing options for tenants across our state, and provides significant benefits for our state and local governments.
But not all local government leaders saw it that way, with many against having to give up local control over zoning decisions. The proposal also received criticism from Republican state lawmakers and some Democrats who represent suburban areas. They say it could change the character of neighborhoods. One of Hochul's primary opponents in the June contest for governor also opposes it. Long Island Congressman Tom Suozzi says it would eviscerate local zoning control and effectively end single-family housing in New York. Suozzi spoke about it to reporters at the state's Democratic Party convention earlier this month.
This accessory dwelling unit thing that she slipped into the State of the State address in the backup budget, this is a debacle. Not only governmentally, I believe, but politically, it is wrong-headed.
Suozzi's home district is part of the New York City suburbs, where voters have often provided a swing vote in past elections. Hochul quietly dropped the proposal one day after the convention at the start of the President's Day holiday weekend. The governor, speaking earlier this week, says her decision had nothing to do with her political opponent. Hochul says she's responding to local government leaders who are against it.
But I realize in talking to many of my partners in local government, I just spoke to the Association of Towns this morning. I spoke to leadership of the mayors, as well as Long Island senators, Democratic senators from Long Island.
And she says she may instead include funding for localities who choose to allow the ADUs. She says the mayor of New York City, Eric Adams, has asked for the authority to create a program.
Accommodating local needs. The mayor wants this. We'll support it. Other communities want to have conversations about different ways to do it. Those are the conversations I'll have as well.
Hochul says the ADU proposal is just one of many ideas she's proposed to help solve the housing crisis, which includes creating 100,000 new affordable housing units over the next 5 years. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
A U.S.-Canada study group charged with studying and making recommendations to mitigate flooding in the Northern Lake Champlain Basin and the river that it flows into held a series of virtual meetings recently. The Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley with this update.
The International Joint Commission was created by the two countries to approve projects and investigate issues affecting boundary waters across the international border. Following flooding in 2011 of Lake Champlain and the Richelieu River, the commission was asked to study causes, impacts, risks, and determine possible solutions to flooding in the watershed basin. The International Lake Champlain Richelieu River Study Board held 4 meetings recently to present key findings of the multi-year study and take input on recommendations. U.S. Board Co-Chair Deborah Lee is the director of NOAA's Great Lakes Environmental Research Laboratory. She explained the board is nearing the completion of the study and preparing to submit a final report to the IJC.
The study board's work is focused on understanding the causes and impacts of past floods, investigating floodplain best management practices, developing flood adaptation strategies, evaluating a binational flood forecasting system, investigating potential flood management and mitigation measures, and evaluating the social and political perception to the proposed measures. This last element is new. Instead of waiting until after the study's completed, we're currently assessing the acceptability of the measures we're proposing.
The study's research included assessing how to reduce high water levels and flooding impacts through moderate structural solutions, reducing vulnerability to high water, enhancing flood response, and improving floodplain management. Canadian co-chair Jean-Francois Canton explained through an interpreter that the governments asked for an assessment of moderate structural solutions to flooding.
Meaning that the board would not be looking at large structures such as dams to control water levels. The solutions identified would lower water levels during floods, resulting in reduced damages in both the US and Canada. The two potential options that the study is considering have the added benefit of raising water levels during low flow periods as well.
During questions, the board was asked about how atmospheric conditions create weather patterns that could contribute to potential flooding. Deborah Lee said there are a number of factors that could affect moisture in the basin.
Lake Champlain does experience many atmospheric phenomena, such as the remnants of tropical systems, stalled thunderstorm fronts, snowfall, a snowpack that can have a rapid melt, increasing precipitation due to a warming climate where the atmosphere is just holding more moisture. So when a cold front comes across that moisture, you have heavier and more intense rain. And then there's also the jet stream. So there are many different collisions of atmospheric events that can cause intense precipitation.
The study board is taking public comments until March 4th. Recommendations will be submitted to the International Joint Commission at the end of March. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Environmental guidelines around the world that dictate how much salt pollution is allowable in freshwater, lakes, streams, and wetlands are failing to protect ecosystems, even in countries with the strictest thresholds. That's according to a new study published in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. One lake included as part of the study on how road salt affects aquatic species is Lake George. Researchers have been monitoring the effects of road salt and local attempts to reduce the use of the common de-icer. The Legislative Gazette's Lucas Willard spoke with Dr. Rick Relier, director of the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute's Darren Freshwater Institute on Lake George, about the new study.
When we got together with colleagues a few years ago, we were trying to understand what salt does around the world to animals and plants that live in fresh water. And what we quickly realized is the thresholds that are set for not having an impact, that is the EPA thresholds, Environmental Canada thresholds, et cetera, they were based on really scant data. That is, road salt had not really risen to the level where people were paying attention to it. So those thresholds were based on not very much data. So all of us got together who work on this issue around the Europe, Canada, the US, and we decided that what we needed to do was do a series of identical experiments across different research labs in Europe, Canada, and the US, where a lot of ice and snow happens and a lot of road salt is dropped to make roads safer, and ask what happens in your part of the world, what happens in our part of the world, and put all that together. And that's what the study does.
One of the key findings of this study was the relationship between road salt and phytoplankton. First, can you explain what phytoplankton are?
Yeah. So that's one of those words that is just a science word for algae. So phytoplankton is what makes lakes really green or not so green, depending on how much is in the water. So this study really looked at the whole base of the food web, that is the algae or the phytoplankton, and the tiny animals that eat it, which we call the zooplankton. So the question was, what happens at different amounts of salt? How much salt does it take to have a negative impact on the zooplankton, these tiny animals that eat algae? And what's the indirect effect, if any, on what happens to the algae when you kill off a lot of the tiny animals that eat it?
So I'm guessing the zooplankton are a lot more sensitive to the salt loading than the phytoplankton, meaning when you load up the lake with salt, road salt runoff, it affects the zooplankton. They're not eating as much algae, and then that leads to an algae bloom.
Right. So that's the gist of it. So what we're looking for really is, we know that zooplankton are among the most sensitive animals to most pollutants, whether it's pesticides, road salt, other things. So we and lots of other people, EPA, et cetera, we commonly look to zooplankton as the most sensitive group. And if you protect them, you essentially protect everybody else. So that's why the focus is on zooplankton. And we look at lots of different species of zooplankton that live in lakes, as did our colleagues around the world who participated in this study. And what we wanted to know is, how much would it take to start killing them? How much salt would it take? And is that amount an amount that's above the threshold, or is it below the threshold for what governments are saying is safe? And the answer is, in most of these places, the thresholds that we currently have are not protecting zooplankton from being impacted by road salt.
There's discussion around algae blooms that there are multiple causes when it comes to either, you know, increased sunlight or increased water temperature, nutrient loading. But does this study and its shown effects on phytoplankton and zooplankton, does this more conclusively tilt the scales towards road salt as a primary cause of algae blooms?
So we have to think about what an algae bloom is. And an algae bloom is simply an increase in the amount of algae in the water. We want to differentiate any regular algae bloom from what we would call a harmful algae bloom, which a harmful algal bloom often is associated with very green water, a film of algae on the surface, which is really a special group of algae we call cyanobacteria. And we really care about them also because sometimes they make toxins that are harmful to people and animals, like nerve toxins, liver toxins, etc. So when it comes to algae, anytime you kill off the animals that eat algae, you typically will see more algae. And that's what we saw in this study. This wasn't focused on harmful algal blooms, but just increases in algae in general. So I don't think this study really speaks to how much, if any, that road salt contributes to harmful algal blooms. Certainly, the primary driver of harmful algal blooms has got to be excess nutrients feeding the algae so that they can bloom. But you're absolutely right that harmful algal blooms are a really complex topic. There are physical factors, chemical factors, biological factors, and we're frankly just trying to understand all of those. And I mean researchers around the world trying to untangle that complexity. So this is really about killing off zooplankton causing increases in algae, more so than whether that contributes to the very detrimental, harmful algal blooms.
So advocates for Lake George and researchers like yourself have often said that Lake George serves as a model, or can serve as a model, for the rest of the state and the rest of the nation. And with the changes, the New York State DOT has been all in on the pilot programs to reduce salt use, to use the brine mixtures instead of road salt on the road in the wintertime, as one example. The communities around the lake have bought into that as well. So with studies like this, can this study now be applied to, change regulations in other states to get other states and other lakes and other watersheds to take steps to reduce salt use?
So there's a lot in that question, but let me touch on different parts of it. So this study absolutely calls attention to not just state governments, but national governments in terms of the thresholds of impact are far too high. That is, they're not being protective of the aquatic organisms living in lakes. We now know that. We didn't have a clear indication of that prior to this study. So we have a very good indication that the increased amount of salt being applied to roads and other sources of salt from agriculture, et cetera, is starting to cause freshwater organisms to live in saltwater environments, and that's not a place where they do well. So they're not adapted to saltwater environments, right? So it's also true that, these organisms are the basis of the whole food web. So these tiny zooplankton that we talk about, they're the basis of what the small fish eat, and then the big fish eat the small fish. So we need to think about how a whole ecosystem gets affected by salt. But what we now know is that those safety thresholds are far too high for many regions of the world. We now know that whereas, say, the US EPA has a level of about 230 milligrams per liter as a level that, you know, below that shouldn't have an impact, we know now in our studies that it's not 230, it might be 20, far lower than we ever knew in different places around the world. But you're also exactly right in the other part of your question in that the communities around Lake George have really embraced the changes that we can do. You talked about brining. We talk about, you know, live edge plows, which are segmented plows to get more snow off the road. Smarter applications, calibrating the salt trucks, all of these things, and getting everyone involved from the municipalities all the way down, you know, to the folks applying the salt, getting people involved who are private contractors putting salt on parking lots. All of that matters, and all of that is helping reduce the amount of salt. So, as I recall, the town of Hague has reduced their salt by more than 50% in the last few years without compromising road safety. And that's the key, is that this isn't a matter of the environment versus safe roads. We can accomplish both of those things. And that's such an unusual situation for an environmental problem that there is no real trade-off here. And there isn't a trade-off because people have learned how to do this in a smarter way. For all the ways you mentioned, brining roads, new plows, calibrations, all of these things of the salt trucks, all of that allows us to put less salt on the roads while maintaining as good or better levels of road safety. That protects the lake, that protects tourism, that protects the local economy. It lowers the cost of salt applications for the towns and cities around any lake. And that reduces the tax burden by having lower costs of salt application. So it's a win all the way around. We now know that we can do this, and we also know that we need to do this.
That's the Legislative Gazette's Lucas Willard speaking with Dr. Rick Relier, director of RPI's Darren Freshwater Institute on Lake George. And that about does it for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. For copies, call 1-800-323-9262. That's 1-800-323-9262. That's for program number 2208. Or just listen or schedule a podcast on the web at wamc.org. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina.